I was getting confirmed in Christ Church in Durham Street in Belfast. And we were in the church and all when the minister was doing, you know, everything. And the next thing, the sirens went. And the minister says, we'll have to stop. And you have to run, get home as quick as you can, you know. So we had to run up the Grumman Road to Drew Street. But at the moment, Drew Street, and then there was the Royal Inn. You remember the Dave Dunville Park facing? We had to run there to the school. And I don't know what your religion you are or anything, but it was mostly Catholics was there at the time. And we walked in, and I was in my white coat with my white veil and my white on. Lovely, I was lovely, 14, mommy and daddy and all. And all I heard was a wee woman said, "Oh my God, there's an angel coming to bless us, coming to save us."
I done IRP till joined up Marnigan Army. I was here. I was in the IRP during the Blitz. We weren't too bad now. There was only two big explosions, landmines, and the rest was all incendiary bombs that we had to put out. They were dropping in groups, and you had to, if they were on the road there, you just put sandbags over them. And if they're in houses, you just threw them through the window. To save the house, you just had to get them on a shovel and just throw them out of the window there. And I was here for the three raids. There was two big, there was one small raid and two big raids, and I was here during the whole raid. I was working then. The raid started about 11 o'clock at night, and the sirens went. I went down the Donegal Road and went down the pass. I went in the Crummock Square, and not a sinner did I see on that whole trip. The raid hadn't started, but the sirens had went. I got to Crummock Square, and the bombs started dropping. Well, I took off, and if I had a time, me, I bet you I would have broke all world records running up to the Ravenhill Road. And there was two guys out of the posts. I'd standing in the corner of the Ravenhill Road underneath the bridge. And I said to them, "Tell them I'm in there." And I went down and it didn't change. I just put the helmet on and my gas mask, and that was all. And then the raid started, and it didn't end until about 5 o'clock in the morning. The planes come over in droves.
Those were the voices of Harriet Smith and Terry Dixon giving their account of the Belfast Blitz in 1941 to the Northern Ireland War Memorial's Oral History Project. This month's episode of the Historical Belfast podcast is brought to you in conjunction with the Northern Ireland War Memorial Museum on Talbot Street, who have kindly given me access to their oral history archive. I'm also extremely grateful for the research and writing of the late historian Jonathan Barden on this subject, and as such, this episode is dedicated to Dr. Barden. 80 years ago, in the course of four Luftwaffe attacks during the Second World War, lasting 10 hours in total, 1,100 people died, over 56,000 homes were damaged, and 100,000 people were made homeless. The first attack on Belfast came on the night of the 7th of April. The docks area was attacked with great accuracy, though residential housing was hit too. The docks raid, as it became known, was small in comparison to the Easter raid, which followed on the night of the 15th of April, and the focus of this episode. The Easter raid remains Belfast's single greatest tragedy in its history. Hundreds died and many more were injured. It was the greatest loss of life outside of London in a single night raid during the blitzing of the United Kingdom. Earlier in the day, on that Tuesday, a large crowd had turned out at Windsor Park to watch Linfield take on Distillery. However, few, if any, of the spectators would have noticed a lone Luftwaffe Junker aircraft circling the stadium. So preoccupied would they have been with the game as Linfield went down 3-1 to the Whites. For the first time since the war began, Northern Ireland's capital city was Adolf Hitler's primary target. Some had predicted it would come, but most weren't listening. The reasons for targeting Belfast are plain. Harland and Wolff was one of the largest shipbuilding yards in the world and constructed many ships for the Royal Navy, including aircraft carriers such as HMS Formidable and HMS Unicorn, cruisers such as HMS Belfast and HMS Penelope, as well as 131 other naval vessels. At the same time, Short Brothers made the Short Sunderland flying boat and the Short Stirling long-range heavy bomber. Mackey's was a prime supplier of anti-aircraft shells, while the Sirocco works at Bridge End produced heating and ventilation equipment for the underground munitions factories in Britain. I've been chatting to Alan Freeburn, who is the collections officer at the Northern Ireland War Memorial, and he elaborated on some of the reasons why Belfast was targeted in 1941.
Yep. So initially Belfast, you know, as the war started, Belfast wasn't really a target. But as the war developed, you know, so you're going through the events of 1939-1940, through the fall of France, the Battle of Britain, and then into the beginning of the Blitz period, it was inevitable that Belfast was going to be bombed. You know, it made sense for us strategically for a number of reasons. It's almost a cliche, you know, but it was targeted primarily for the docks, what we call Belfast Harbour Estate. You know, so much was concentrated in this area. You know, when I'm talking to groups, I like to sort of use analogy, you know, it's a bit like a funnel. You know, you've got the whole of Northern Ireland's industrial and economic agricultural output, and it's all going through the port of Belfast. So it's all coming through the six counties back through into Belfast. So it's where it all narrows together and it's all concentrated there. So you obviously had the heavy industries like Holland and Wolff, which at the time was one of the largest shipyards in the UK. So they weren't only building ships, they're obviously repairing, refitting, not only ships for the Royal Navy, but also commercial ships as well. You had Shorts Aircraft Factory, and there through the war, they produced Sunderland flying boats and Stirling bombers. But there was also a number of other large industries located nearby. So you had the Ropeworks in East Belfast, there on the Conswater. You had York Street Spinning Mill and Gallagher's Tobacco Factory in North Belfast. And additionally, all the infrastructure in Belfast too made it a target. So within the harbour estate, you had the Harbour Power Station, which was in East Twin Islands. You have all the major railway yards. So you have Adelaide, you have Great Victoria Street, you have the BCDR there. You have on York Street as well, the LMS there. So there's a lot of, you know, say strategic targets in the area. So all the goods that were produced in Northern Ireland that would have been exported to Great Britain to aid the war effort, they would have flowed primarily through the port of Belfast. So as well as that, then the harbour was also a base for trawlers and convoy escorts as well. So there's a whole reason why it was targeted, and it was only really with the fall of France where the Luftwaffe were able to occupy airfields in northern France and Belgium and the Low Countries that Belfast came to be within range for the Luftwaffe.
Despite this, the Northern Ireland government did not appreciate until it was too late that an aerial attack was possible or even likely. Belfast's defences were hopelessly insufficient, with few anti-aircraft guns, lack of searchlights, too few firemen and air raid wardens, as well as inadequate air raid shelters. Unlike other UK cities, the people of Belfast were physically and psychologically unprepared for an oncoming blitz. And so, after a dull day in Belfast, the sky began to clear on Easter Tuesday evening as 180 German bombers took off from aerodromes in northern France. Their crews had closely studied photographs taken 5 months previously by a Luftwaffe reconnaissance plane, and they memorised their principal targets. Die Werft Harland & Wolff Limited, Die Tankstelle Conswater, Das Flugzeugwerk Short and Harland, Das Kraftwerk Belfast, Die Großmühle Rank & Co. I always knew that my A in GCSE German would come in handy someday. It was never in doubt. Belfast's codename was ETAP, which translates from German to mean a stage or a heat of a race. Take from that what you will.
Well, Germany had already demonstrated that Belfast was within range. Belfast Lock, to that point in the summer of 1940, had been frequently mined from the air by the Luftwaffe. And even on one occasion, the Condor even went on to drop incendiary bombs on Bangor in September 1940. So there was enemy activity in the skies over Northern Ireland. They were regularly performing reconnaissance flights over the city, taking photos for intelligence, and they identified a number of targets. So funny enough, these target folders survived the war, and they're actually held by the Imperial War Museum. Anybody can go on their website, and you can just search you know, Belfast or target folder, and you'll see a whole list of UK-wide of these targets across the UK, but there are Belfast-specific ones. So things, they have target folders for places such as Shorts and Harnham Wolf, the power station in the harbour, Victoria Barracks, Ranks Flour Mill, and even the waterworks. So these folders obviously compose of aerial photography, but there's also photographs of the buildings themselves as well. So they're incredibly detailed. And it's not just Belfast. You know, these places, also all the airfields across Northern Ireland are identified. There's places like Larne, Holywood, which I assume, I haven't actually seen it, but I assume probably means Palace Barracks. You have Dundrum, which I assume is probably Ballykinler without seeing it. And then also Derry as well is also included in these target folders. Additionally, in the museum here at the War Memorial, we hold an original full-colour target map of Belfast. So it's actually based on an Ordnance Survey map of the city. And forgive my German, but it is entitled Stadtplan von Belfast, which I'm pretty sure just translates to City Map of Belfast. And it was used by Luftwaffe or German intelligence to highlight targets and landmarks to aid their pilots when flying over the city. So on the map, you have those targets that I've already mentioned. So Horn the Wolf, Shorts, Palace Barracks, but also landmarks, things. So places like City Hall, Inst is identified on it, Stormont, Queens as well, as are all the main railway stations in Goodyard. So Adelaide, what today is Central, LMS, the BCDR. And it even goes down to identifying each mill in the city. So over all the sort of the rivers and the waterways in West Belfast, there's little purple circles with an I in the middle of it. And they are the mills. So a lot of them in West Belfast, lots of them in East Belfast as well. And then again, also the waterworks are identified as well.
As they approached the Ards Peninsula, the German raiders dropped to 7,000 feet. The pilots were in high spirits. One remembered, "We were in exceptional good humour, knowing that we were going for a new target, one of England's last hiding places. Wherever Winston Churchill is hiding his war material, we will go. Belfast is as worthy a target as Coventry, Birmingham, Bristol or Glasgow." At 10:40 p.m, the air raid sirens in Belfast began to wail. The elite Pathfinder Squadron, Kampfgruppe 100, led the first wave of bombers. The city glowed as flares rained down from the sky. These were followed by incendiaries and explosives, including 76 landmines designed to rip through the concrete and steel of factories. They floated down in silky green parachutes onto the cramped housing of Inner North and Inner East Belfast. It is thought that the Germans mistook the waterworks for the docks. The result was terrible destruction and carnage for the New Lodge, Antrim Road, Lower Shankill and Newtonards Road areas. 203 metric tons of bombs and parachute mines, along with 800 firebomb canisters, were cast down by those 180 German bombers. In Varian Gardens and Van Dyck Gardens, 130 homes were destroyed, and in one house, 8 members of the Danby family were killed. York Street Spinning Mill, the largest of its kind in Europe, was sliced in two. The collapsing 6 stories obliterated 42 houses in Sussex Street and Vere Street. In Ballinuir Street, a bomb struck a house and 9 people were killed. At the Ulster Hall on Bedford Street, the legendary Irish folk singer and song collector Delia Murphy was in the midst of a performance when the raid began. She continued singing through the bombing raid, perhaps saving many lives, as the sturdily built venue was safer than many of the nearby air raid shelters. However, some of her audience decided to take refuge in Percy Street, but a parachute mine fell next to it and 30 people were killed. At 1:45 a.m, a bomb fell at the corner of Oxford Street and East Bridge Street, wrecking the city's central telephone exchange. All contact with Britain and the anti-aircraft control room was cut off. As a result, the defensive guns now fell silent, too afraid that they might shoot down the RAF's Hurricane fighters, which, unbeknown to Belfast, had actually been withdrawn by Fighter Command. For the next 2 hours, The Luftwaffe attacked Belfast entirely unopposed, with bombs falling at a rate of one every minute. Around 140 fires raged across the city by this point. One eyewitness recalled, "The sky was red, pure red. You would have thought that someone had set fire to the world." Then, to make matters worse, the water pressure fell away in areas where the pipes had been cracked by explosions. One Luftwaffe pilot described how he saw Belfast. He spoke of whole blocks of buildings set on fire, pouring out smoke, flashes of lightning from exploding bombs coming towards us hundreds of metres in the air. From his home in East Belfast, John Clark McDermott, the Minister of Public Security, watched as flames engulfed the city. At 4:15 a.m, as he heard the crash of his shattered windows, he crawled under his desk and made arrangements to seek help from Neutral Era. This was not McDermott's first experience of high drama at Easter time. On Easter Monday 1916, he and a friend, Robert Orchard, decided to take a day trip to Dublin, which, as a consequence of the Easter Rising, resulted in the two men being stranded in Dublin for a week before walking to Drogheda to get a train back to Belfast. At 4:35 a.m, a telegram was sent by railway telegraph to Dublin. Era's Taoiseach, Eamon de Valera, was awakened from his sleep by Belfast's plea for help, and he agreed without hesitation to send aid to Northern Ireland. Altogether, 70 men and 13 fire engines from Dublin, Dunleary, Drogheda and Dundalk made their way north.
Yeah, so during the Easter raid, the sort of situation was escalating, and it's starting to not get out of control, but sort of realise the scale of the problem they're facing. So a message was sent via the railway telegraph service to Dublin about 4:30 in the morning. And the reason why it was sent by the railway telegraph service was because the phone lines had been destroyed. And it was basically sent to Dublin asking for assistance from the Irish Fire Brigades. This message was then relayed to the Taoiseach, Eamon de Valera. And he was actually woken up from sleep, and he pondered over it for a bit, and he gave authority for the firefighters to cross the border to come to Belfast's aid. The intricacy of it was quite a delicate diplomatic matter. Ireland were still trying to maintain the impression of strict neutrality, sort of between the Germans and the Allied powers as well. But eventually, 70 men on 13 fire engines came from Dublin, Dundalk, Drogheda, and Dunleary. And they crossed the border. Now, I think it's important to stress these men were all volunteers. They all volunteered, and they were reassured before leaving that their pensions were still eligible in the event of injury or death when they were in Belfast as well. So when they left, the roadblocks were ordered to be moved to quicken their journey, and there's a count of them speeding through Lisburn on the way to Belfast at about 60 miles per hour with lights on masks. So they first left Dublin, I think it was quarter past six in the morning, and they were in Belfast for just shortly after 9 o'clock. So I think it's 9:20. So about 3 hours later, they were there, which is pretty good going, even by today's standards. You know, never mind the fact they were crossing the national border, they had a blackout to contend with. And even then, you know, this is 1941. You know, they weren't exactly flying up the road, but it's pretty good going, even by today's standards. So they stayed all day. They were requested, they were asked to see if they could stay and help overnight with what was remaining of the fires and help put them out. But their decision was made in the evening following the raid that southern units were to return home, because they were fearful that there could be a follow-up raid the next night on Belfast, and they didn't want, you know, a diplomatic fallout, let's say, of Dubliners or people, men from Dundalk and men from the south, be killed by a German bomb in Belfast. You know, it would have created sort of diplomatic issue, I'd say. So they went back down home that night. Additionally, there was a crash evacuation after the raid. People fleeing Belfast, a lot of people getting on the train going down south as well. So the Irish Red Cross provided humanitarian aid. So they welcomed and accommodated lots of evacuees from Belfast to train stations at Dundalk, Drogheda, and in Dublin as well.
As they approached the outskirts of the city, the southern firemen saw smoke and flames rising hundreds of feet into the air. Horrified by the carnage, John Smith, Belfast's chief fire officer, was found beneath a table in the Chichester Street fire station, weeping and refusing to come out. Smith was not the only one to be crippled by fear. An American man, seconded to Shorten Harland by the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation, was far from impressed by his fellow workers. In a letter to his parents in California, he wrote, "You've heard about how tough the Irish are. Well, all I can say is that the tough Irish must come from Southern Ireland, because the boys up in Northern Ireland are a bunch of chicken shit yellow bastards. 90% of them left everything and ran like hell. Short and Harlan's, the aircraft factory that built Stirling's here, had 300 volunteer firefighters in the plant. After the raid, they were lucky to get 90 of them. In light of this quote, I asked Alan Freeburn to elaborate on how individuals and authorities responded during the Easter raid.
There were certainly, you know, systematic or institutionalised failures. It's not a coincidence that the fire chief, John Smith, was replaced with Ben White, who was previously the chief of the Auxiliary Fire Service, immediately following the Easter Tuesday raid. Smith was reported to have been found crying under his desk at his headquarters on Chichester Street during the raid. But at the same time, you know, the fire service, they were more limited by their equipment. You know, the equipment in Belfast wasn't standardised. There wasn't enough hose length to reach a Lagan. It was only when the relief fire service from, you know, Glasgow and Liverpool that came over that they had enough hose length to reach the Lagan to help with the water flow. I know it's an issue that the Southern firemen they encountered. You know, not only did their equipment not match the Northern counterparts, but even, you know, different stations in Belfast didn't have the same equipment either. So it's really flawed by that. You know, there's also reports before the Blitz that there wasn't enough firemen, you know, they're on a recruitment drive. But even then, they say they were to double in size. You know, they only recruited half of those that they were allowed to recruit. So there wasn't enough firemen either for certainly an event or a raid the scale of the Easter Tuesday raid. Saying that though, there were a number of firemen who did leave Northern Ireland early in 1941. So they went to, initially, I think it's January, February 1941, they went to London initially, and then they went to the southwest. So they were in, I think off the top of my head, they were in Plymouth, getting training of real Blitz experience. So they, I know there's certainly one man, we have his diary here on loan at the minute in the museum, and he was part of it, and he went there, and he came back, and he's kept his diary. He talks about the real, he was based up in Ardoyne fire station, and actually the fire engine he actually drove is on display actually at the minute, or on permanent display rather I should say, at the Transport Museum over in Cultraw as well. But I mentioned previously that, you know, the fire chief was replaced with the chief of the Auxiliary Fire Service. Just to reinforce that sort of sense of sort of institutional failure, after the May raid, I know we're concentrating on the Easter Tuesday raid, but after the fire raid in May, the deputy ARP officer, Frank Hazlett, he replaced the ARP officer for Belfast, who was a Major Hamill. And he, let's say, he rather euphemistically retired in sort of speech marks. And he was replaced by his deputy, Frank Hazlett, following the raids in May. So there were, you know, lessons that were learned and things weren't done right, let's say. There was the right leadership and things like that as well. But I think it's also important to remember that, you know, majority of these men and women have volunteered for the Civil Defence Services. They were volunteers, you know, not that many of them were in paid professional roles. And you like to think, you know, people like you or myself, you know, if we were in that situation, you like to think how you would react, but you won't know about ever having gone through it yourself. So as a volunteer and you're looking after your local area as well, you know, your sort of first thought would probably, you're trying to put yourself in their shoes, you know, your first thought is going to be, you know, your own family and looking after them and things as well. But I know there are stories of air raid wardens sloping off or firemen running away or John Smith hiding under his desk and such, but several people were commended for their bravery during the Easter Tuesday raid. There were a number of RUC officers were commended. There were a number of ARP messengers, and these ARP messengers were young boys. They were boys who'd volunteered from the Boys Brigade or the Scouts on their bicycles to run messages between ARP posts or their headquarters. Again, members of the Auxiliary Fire Service and air raid wardens, they were also commended for their deeds and their bravery during that raid as well.
At 4:55 a.m. on Wednesday the 16th of April, the all clear finally sounded. At dawn, a thick yellow pall covered Belfast as exhausted air raid wardens, firefighters and ambulance men clawed at the rubble to retrieve survivors. The writer Sam Hannah-Bell remembered, "We wrestled with street doors blown halfway down hallways. From under the stairs of a house, we extracted an old woman, still clutching a miniature Union Jack." Corpses and severed limbs were piled high onto British Army lorries. Many of the dead were brought to the public baths on the Falls Road. As more arrived, the pool was emptied so that 150 corpses could be laid out. One attendant at the Falls Road bath remembered how one coffin contained a young mother with her two dead children, one in each arm. One lovely girl of 16 lay in a coffin in her white confirmation robe with blue silk ribbon and black hair. Thinking back to the oral testimony at the beginning of this episode, that could so easily have been Harriet Smith there in her confirmation dress. Elsewhere, 255 corpses were laid out in St George's Market. I asked Alan Freeburn to elaborate on the process for dealing with the dead of the Blitz.
Yep, so as the raid progressed in the aftermath of the raid, private mortuaries like Melville's on the Townsend Street, Leganbank Mortuary, and even the mortuaries in the hospitals, so at the Mater, at the Union Infirmary, they were full. So bodies were taken to St George's Market and to the public baths on the Falls Road and St Peter's Hill as well. So the bodies were laying out in these places and the public were asked, basically invited to come in and identify the bodies that were there. There's a good account in Emma Duffin's diary. She was a BAD nurse based out at Strandmillis. And she sort of recorded in her diary about the process of St George's Market. And she talks about how in St George's Market, men, coffins of men inside them were laid out on one side of the market and women and children on the other. And only small groups of the public were allowed to come around at one time. So nurses and the men and women who volunteered at the market, I assume they were civil defence volunteers, they would have went around of each group of the public and would have lifted the lids off the coffin for the public to try and identify who was inside it. So she says there was men watering the ground with disinfectant from watering pots. And she notes it was a wise precaution as the place smelt. And as each person was identified, the nurses would have put the name of the body on the coffin and it was removed to the side to be taken away by their relatives for burial. She notes that on some coffins, the notes were written in chalk, such as where the body was found, maybe a rough description of who or what they contained. So it's important to remember that something, how sort of gruesome and awful it would have been. You know, in these coffins, it wouldn't have been whole bodies. There's reports of particularly charred bodies as well, maybe a human hand or, you know, human remains. Sometimes it's not very pleasant reading, actually. It's hard to imagine just what it would have been like. At the Falls Road bath, it's the same sort of process. You know, when the space ran out as though there, the actual swimming pool was drained and the bodies were laid out on the bottom of the pool as well. The public invited to come in and identify it. I know Jimmy Doherty, he was there for a bit, helping to, he was an air raid warden in North Belfast trying to help people identify their relatives or the people who were unidentified at that point. I know he mentions when he arrived that there was a human hand just waiting to sit at the door. You know, it wasn't associated with anything. It's just that was his first sight when he arrived there to help out. But the thing was, after a few days, for health and sanitation reasons, the bodies lay for identification for 5 days. And on 21st of April, those that were not identified or claimed, they were taken away to be buried in mass graves. There are 3 mass graves in Belfast for those killed in the Blitz. There is one at Milltown and there are 2 at Belfast City Cemetery. So there's one at City Cemetery for those who are unidentified and unclaimed. And there is another for those who were identified but were not claimed by their relatives. So that might be because maybe the relatives didn't have the means for private burial, or maybe there was a fact that maybe a whole family were killed and there was nobody to claim the burial or the bodies anymore. And the way that sort of identified was if there's any sort of religious items, if there's a crucifix or anything like that, they would have went to been buried in Milltown. So there are a number of bodies. I know in Bethel City Cemetery, there are 154 unidentified. And 123 of these are from the Easter Tuesday raid and 31 are from the May raid. And then there are 34 victims that are unclaimed buried in the mass grave City Cemetery as well. Now, I want to throw out as well, though, that for the Easter Tuesday raid, you sort of see the figure of there was about 900 or 1,000 people killed during this raid. But that figure has been inflated over the years. I don't know, I don't know where it originated from, but it's not that high. There's about just short of 1,000 people killed altogether over the Belfast Blitz, and that includes those who were killed in Newtownards and in Bangor and in Derry as well. But for the Easter Tuesday raid, it's between 740 and 750 people that died as a result of enemy action on Easter Tuesday, and then as I said, was just under 1,000 people across the whole of the four raids across Northern Ireland died across the four raids, as opposed to more.
Meanwhile, widespread looting and panic reigned. One of those interviewed for the NI War Memorial's oral history project, Tom Hanna, lightheartedly recalled how, as a nine-year-old boy, he endeavoured to make the most of the situation.
McKenna and McGinley was hit on Devon Street. That was a big bottling firm, you know. Sold lemonade. I remember it getting hit, but that was about 500 or 600 metres away from us, you know. We did feel the house being shaken, you know. The sky was lit up, completely lit up, an orange, you name the colour, it was in the sky that night. The very next night, we were first on the scene. I was about nine then, or coming nine. And the first thing we did, about five or six of us, we went down into this place in Devon Street. There was a store, a toy store. It was either on the corner of Fountain Street or College Court, I think there was one called, led into Castle Street. It got a direct hit. And we had to enter that there as 9 and 10 year olds along a 15 foot wall at the rear of the premises. And there we scrambled all through the rubble. I found little lead soldiers on a card. There was about 9 or 10 on a card. Building blocks, even dolls, you know, little girls' dolls, and toys of every description. And there I was filling. I had a jerkin on. A jerkin was a wee thing, corduroy jerkin with a zip on it. And I had the zip down and floated with all the toys, pulled up the zip, backtracked along the 15-foot wall at the rear of the premises, and scarbered home with all the toys.
That was exciting.
Dangerous. So that was an adventure. Yeah. That's why I didn't mind the war. And a few, one or two bricks, as you were walking, edging your way along the wall, one or two bricks would fall out. Made the journey all the more hazardous on the way back again.
And what did you do with all the toys?
Well, I played with them. And I think I sold some of them too, you know. I remember selling to the fella next door. He was the same age as myself, called Sean Healy. I remember selling him a little card of soldiers for sixpence. That was 6 pence, which is 2.5 pence by the day's money. So he got a card of soldiers for six pence.
In the 24 hours after the Easter raid, 220,000 people fled the city. Around 6,000 terrified people arrived in Dublin from Belfast, including an air raid warden still wearing his helmet. In the days that followed, tens of thousands poured out of the city for the countryside. Children clutched their favourite dollies, many brought with them their pets from budgerigars to tabbies, reported the Belfast Telegraph. It was an en masse exodus. It introduced those in the countryside to the extreme deprivation of the people from Belfast. Moya Woodside's sister, living 30 miles from Belfast, complained of the, quote, appalling influx from the slums the day after the raid. The whole town is horrified by the filth of these evacuees and by their filthy habits and take-it-for-granted attitude. The smell is awful. They don't even use the lavatory. They just do it on the floor, grown-ups and children. Of those that stayed in Belfast, 40,000 had to be put up in rest centres, while 70,000 had to be fed in emergency feeding centres. However, the official response of the authorities to the crisis was, on the whole, underwhelming. One reaction from the Ministry of Public Security was to issue an order on the 19th of April to, quote, destroy all dangerous animals at the zoo immediately. Consequently, two RUC marksmen were dispatched to Bellevue Zoo. The head keeper, a man called Dick Foster, stood by with tears streaming down his face as the executioners proceeded from cage to cage, dispatching the animals, 33 in total, as well as a vulture. On the following Monday, many of the unclaimed dead were buried in mass graves, Protestants in the city cemetery, and Catholics identified by rosary beads and other emblems in Milltown Cemetery close by. On this, the 80th anniversary of the Belfast Blitz, the Northern Ireland War Memorial have organised an exciting programme of events. I asked Alan to tell us about the plans.
Yeah, so obviously our usual preparations, what we usually would have done for the anniversary of the Blitz, which you mark every year, has been affected by COVID. But this year we are going to have a private wreath laying ceremony at the mass graves at Milltown and the Belfast City Cemetery. And again, there is a memorial in the museum. We'll have a private wreath laying ceremony there. All being well, our new website will have launched by then, hopefully. And on that, there'll be a memorial page to the victims containing a short biography of the victims, and where available, there will be a photo as well. So it's just not, you know, it's not just going to be a list of names in the previous cases. It is, there actually is, it's a bit more personal, a little bit more about the person. And in some cases, there'll be a, you'll be able to put a face to the name as well. We are also reprinting the names in of all those who were killed in the Blitz in the major papers. So in the Belfast Telegraph, the Irish News, and the Newsletter, just like the death notices basically were at the time, you know, as a result of army action, and then you would have had the names listed and the family notices basically as well. Additionally, we have a couple of partnerships on the go at the minute as well. Firstly, worth mentioning is we have a lecture series with the Public Records Office. So it'll be looking at different aspects of the Blitz, including the victims, with Emma Duffin I've mentioned about, the firemen who we've talked about as well, and what sources exist at the Public Records Office and in Prony, along with what NI Screen hold as well. On top of that, the second project that we have launched this year, I'm sure maybe some people have seen it as well, is we have started working with the Geography Department at Queen's University on that map that I was talking about earlier, the Luftwaffe map, the Stadtplan von Belfast, to plot. Basically, it's going to be an open source web map of, and it's that Luftwaffe map is going to be the base layer. So on that map, we are plotting the victims of the Belfast Blitz. So it's going to give, you know, a different visual representation of how Belfast was affected. And it's as well as that, there are a number of different layers we're looking to add to that as well, including photographs and aerial photographs as well, just to show how Belfast was affected, both physically, but and how the people of Belfast were affected as well. So it's still in its early days, but it is ongoing at the minute. Additionally to that, we also have a couple of sort of craft packs as such that we have released as well. So the first one is a pack for primary schools. It's full of facts and first-hand accounts and craft activities as well. So it's designed for parents, for teachers to pick up for their classes for their school children who have just came back this week. And then as well as that, there are reminiscence packs for community groups and care homes. So within that, there again, there are, you know, crafts, first-hand accounts and facts and so on, but there are also a CD of songs and spoken memories as well. So we're really trying to target all the different sort of audiences we can, particularly trying to overcome the barriers of COVID has obviously brought this year, trying to get around that as much as possible.
Thank you as ever for listening to this edition of the Historical Belfast podcast. If you enjoyed it, I would encourage you to check out the previous 12 episodes and share them on your social media. Also remember to leave a review if you're listening on platforms like Apple Podcasts. It helps me get up the charts and get the podcast to the people who need to hear it. My thanks again to the Northern Ireland War Memorial for working with me on this episode, and I hope to see some of you down at the museum as soon as the circumstances permit it. The maid shakes her head on her lip, lays her fingers, steals up from the seat, longs to go, and yet lingers. A frightened glance turns on her drowsy grandmother, puts one foot on the stool, spins the wheel with the other. Lazily, easily swings now the wheel round, slowly and now the real sound, noiseless and light to the lattice above her, the maid creeps then leaps to the arms of her lover. Slower and slower and slower the wheel swings, lower and lower and lower the reel rings, ere the reel and the wheel stopped their ringing. Through the grove, the young lovers by moonlight.